Welcome to Native America Calling from Studio 49 in Albuquerque. I'm Monica Brain. A measure that would help tribes prosecute non-tribal members who abuse women moved ahead in Congress. But is there enough support to push it through? Also, on her first day in office, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland sent a signal to Native media. We'll find out what that is and hear about her priorities for the future. And an Asian journalist group calls for more responsible reporting. Their criticisms parallel complaints from Native journalists. Those stories and more on our news roundup. We'll be right back.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The pandemic has highlighted water and sanitation needs in Alaska Native communities, where lack of infrastructure has already had significant health impacts, according to a health official. Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Interim President Valerie Davidson testified virtually this week before the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs on water infrastructure needs. Davidson says many families in rural communities do not have running water to help prevent the spread of COVID-19, like constant hand washing and cleaning. Davidson says more than 40% of Alaska Native homes lack running water.
Many communities typically have a washateria building. It's one building that combines water treatment, laundromat, toilets, and showers that the entire community uses. And what that means from a practical perspective is that those communities haul their water from the washateria in a 5-gallon clean bucket, and we haul our raw sewage from our home in a different 5-gallon bucket. And unfortunately, some of our communities continue to be unserved simply because of the high construction costs.
Among recommendations, Davidson says they desperately need at least $1 billion for sanitation construction in future legislation and resources to preserve what infrastructure is already in place. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has signed off on the Ho-Chunk Nation's plans to build a casino just north of the Illinois border. Danielle Kading reports.
Federal law gives governors the power to block or approve off-reservation casinos. The tribe's plans include one of the largest casinos in the state, along with a convention center, indoor water park, and a 300-room hotel. The complex is expected to create more than 1,500 permanent jobs and more than 2,000 construction jobs. Ho-Chunk Nation Public Relations Officer Ryan Greendeer says jobs are a central focus, as many tribal communities shut down their casinos for months last year due to COVID-19.
This is going to be the cornerstone of the economic recovery from the pandemic.
The complex will be built in the city of Beloit. Beloit City Council President Regina Duncan says the project has been a long time coming.
And is a game changer for Beloit in terms of jobs created, shared revenues, and increased tourism.
The project now faces final approval from the Department of Interior. Once approved, Wisconsin's governor and the Ho-Chunk Nation would amend the tribe's gaming compact to include revenues from the new casino. I'm Danielle Kading.
Native vote advocates in Montana are pushing back on bills they say would restrict voting access. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Bills introduced this session would end voter registration on the day of elections, require photo IDs both to register and vote in person, and restrict ballot collecting, a common practice on reservations. Keaton Sunchild with Western Native Voice says state Republicans proposing this legislation claim there was fraud in the 2020 election, despite their party's big gains in the state legislature and in the governor's office.
That's why we're just a little bit confused as to why some parts of the election seem to be okay, but some parts don't.
Lawmakers in support of these efforts have been pushing for election integrity, saying the state needs to secure its elections and that voting comes with responsibilities, such as registering before Election Day. The ballot collection bill in the legislature is nearly identical to the Ballot Interference Protection Act, which was struck down in September. Sunchild says the voting method is common on reservations, where post offices or voting locations might be far away. His group and others instead are supporting the Native American Voting Rights Act, which would lower barriers for voting, such as requiring 2 permanent satellite election offices on reservations.
Give Native Americans on reservations the same protections that non-reservation folks have here in Montana.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps. Members who serve in VISTA fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills. Rewarding service opportunities are available in communities across America. Info at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribal relations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. The U.S. House of Representatives passed another reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. It's important because funding for the legislative fix for tribal jurisdiction ran out 3 years ago, and several attempts to get it going since then have failed. Today, we'll learn what might be still standing in the way. Also, coverage of the recent mass shooting in Atlanta brought criticism from the Asian American Journalists Association. We'll talk with a representative from the organization on what the problems are and some parallels to coverage of Native issues. But first, Deb Haaland made history this month by becoming the first Native American cabinet secretary, heading the Department of Interior. One of her first acts was to meet with Native journalists. To tell us about the significance of this is Lindsay Crable Burton. She's the vice president of the Native American Journalists Association and an education reporter for the Tulsa World. And Lindsay is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Welcome back, Lindsay.
CO, thank you for having me.
All right. So how significant is it that Secretary Haaland met with Native journalists? I think it was the first or second day of her job.
It was the first full day. We actually got to meet with her before she met with President Biden in person. So,
wow.
I think we were all a little taken aback, actually, when that was brought up at the briefing. It's hard to understate that, you know, given that Native journalists account for less than 1% of all of mainstream newsrooms nationwide, and. You know, I mean, yes, obviously we have so many indigenous journalists doing fabulous things in tribal newsrooms, but not everybody's necessarily able to grab a copy of their tribe's newspaper or to catch their tribe's radio show. So making a point to sit down via Zoom and chat with folks who cover the communities that will be directly impacted by actions taken by Interior. It's almost impossible to understate that.
Yeah, I just want to throw that out there to our listeners. You know, if you want to weigh in on how you feel about Congresswoman Deb Haaland now becoming Secretary of the Interior, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. What do you think about her meeting with Native journalists, her first full day on the job? Give us a call. Share your thoughts. 1-800-99-NATIVE. What did she talk about with the journalists in the meeting?
Well, it was an on the record briefing, and we all were journalists, had to take advantage of that and get some questions in, ranging anywhere from McGirt, the implications of the McGirt ruling, to some of the concerns raised by Freedmen descendants about her co-sponsorship of the Mahazda bill a couple of years ago. What Interior stance will be regarding tribes seeking recognition. There were some questions raised about Chaco, Bears Ears, and some of the other national monuments who had their footprint reduced during the previous administration. It was a 30-minute briefing, so, you know, obviously we couldn't all ask everything we wanted to. I think we all had a laundry list, and it's one of those, okay, holy cow, you're going to get one, maybe two if you're lucky, so you best come correct.
What did you ask her?
I asked about McGirt. I'm based in Tulsa. As you mentioned, I write for the Tulsa World. My home is within a mile of the boundaries between the Muscogee Creek Nation and Cherokee Nation Reservation. So, and there are a few folks around here that are kind of paying attention to what's been going on with, you know, with life after the Supreme Court's ruling. So, mm-hmm. you know, specifically about what role does she see Interior taking as we move forward with, you know, with again, life after McGirt, life after the Supreme Court ruling from last summer.
What did she say? Did she have some insight into it? Or was it more like, it's something we're going to be looking into?
Well, she mentioned that, you know, after the ruling came down, she made a point to seek out Representative Tom Cole for some advice. And Tom Cole is a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation. Mm-hmm. And at the time, he, you know, right at the time of the ruling, he was her co-chair of the Congressional Native American Caucus. And his advice to her was basically, you know, let the tribes figure this out. Let them work it out. Congress doesn't need to get involved. And she said, for now, you know, Interior is watching, but they're going to follow that guidance and let the tribes out here handle it. I will mention that, you know, Brian Newland, the former Bay Mills chairman, was also on, who's also now at Interior. He was also on, and he mentioned that they will, you know, Interior will be maintaining their trust responsibilities to the tribes out here.
Yeah.
So, but they're not going to be actively taking a role like, you know, when that case was litigated last year, you know, the Trump administration had filed in opposition to the tribes. Mm. State of Oklahoma obviously was not particularly keen on the reservation being reinstated. So mm-hmm. we're not necessarily going to be seeing that approach from Interior. It's at least if that was their from the tone of their comments. So,
yeah. Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see how all of that rolls out with that case in particular. You know, jurisdictional issues, it's pretty tricky. Let's take a call. We got Michael in Jemez, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there, Michael.
Hey, viewership. Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, Jim Holland is actually a cousin of mine. Our grandpas were brothers, our brothers, and I'm very impressed by her meeting with the Native Press Corps and journalists, because that'll show that Native America will have an inside track on what Joe Biden and the rest of the cabinet secretaries are thinking, and she'll be able to give our perspective, and that'll be a plus, and we'll get a lot of legislation that'll help Native America. So that's a plus, and we keep praying for her continued success as Secretary of the Interior.
Thanks, Michael. Nice to hear from you. And I was able to sit down with her yesterday and interview her about her priorities for the future, and we'll play that a little bit later in the show today. Lindsay, do you think, is there any fear of maybe hearing grumblings from non-Native journalists that we're getting favoritism or, you know, anything like that?
I have not seen or heard yet, but, you know, it's been a week. And to be fair, it's been one heck of a week. We've all been kind of running six ways from Sunday. So, I mean, there's always the possibility once, you know, our non-Native colleagues have had a chance to catch their breath and, you know, wait, what? What'd y'all get to do? How come we didn't get invited? But, it, you know, so far, no, have not. We, you know, Nadja has not received pushback from non-Native journalists asking about how come we got the first sit down. So thankfully.
That's great. That's great to hear. Well, what are your hopes for Secretary Holland at the Interior, Lindsay?
My hope is that this wasn't just a check the box. Okay, we met with y'all. We'll see you later. And, you know, that this is just the first step, and that there will be continued access to where we can actually get, you know, to ask questions and have that insight versus finding out from afar what Interior's, you know, what's going on with Interior, what their goals and plans are for Indian country.
Yeah, and also, you know, we're journalists, so we hold power to account, and we're going to have to ask the tough questions, you know, in the future with her.
It, very much so. It's a little bit easier to ask the tough questions when it's somebody from your community versus a perfect stranger that you don't know. You know, having to come up and do that, and your first introduction is, wait, why are you doing this? What's going on?
Right. Well, let's take another call. We got Melvin in Santee, Nebraska, tuned in KZYK. Hey there, Melvin.
Good morning. My hopes are that the secretary can now deal with the sacred sites issue, grave protection, and the 106 that's happening. And, I'm very glad to hear her back on the show. You know, over the years, she's been on different times on your show, you know, before she was even a representative. And I think it's great that she's sticking with her roots, you know, informing the people, you know, about what she's going to do and doing it on the Indian program. And I think it's great.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you wholeheartedly. Lindsay, anything else you want? We're about to go to break, and I want to continue chatting with you after the break. We're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about responsible headlines and reporting and things like that. But anything else you want to share about Secretary Holland and her first, I think today is day 6 in office?
Nothing relevant. Just like I said, we at Naja are very hopeful that this is not just a one-off, that these opportunities will continue so that we can properly report on these, on this, not just the fact that she's making history, but the impact that her role will have on our communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it'll be interesting to see how she responds to national media as well, and how they respond to her in terms of their coverage. One of my colleagues pointed out that there was some discussion about what she was wearing when she was sworn in. And the thing is that's something that's usually common with female appointees anyway. There's always a discussion, but she wore her traditional dress, and there's a video of her putting her moccasins on, which was pretty awesome, pretty amazing to see. So, we're going to go to a short break. And after the break, we're going to talk about some problematic headlines that came out after the mass shooting in Atlanta. We're going to talk with somebody from the Asian American Journalist Association. If you want to weigh in on that conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. It is our monthly news roundup. I'm Monica Brain, senior producer, and today we are chatting about major news stories across Native America. 1-800-996-2848. Several Native American female artists have made a big impact in the art world. We know their names and are inspired by them because they broke barriers and continue to tell powerful Native stories in film, music, and other media. We're celebrating historic Native women in art on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain. It's our regular news roundup today. If you want to join us, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. On the line, we have Terry Tang. She is a reporter for the race and ethnicity team at the Associated Press and president of the Asian American Journalist Association Arizona chapter. Welcome to Native America Calling, Terry.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Yeah, it's great to talk with you. I wish we were talking about a better topic, but, earlier this month there was a mass shooting in Atlanta, and I'm wondering if you might share a little bit about some of the problematic headlines that came out after this shooting, and maybe give a little bit of a backstory to what happened for our listeners who might not have been following it too closely.
Sure. So
last Tuesday, reports came out about a shooting in the metro Atlanta area, so outside of Atlanta as well, in Cherokee County. And it later came out that a 21-year-old white man had gone to three different massage businesses or spas that were all Asian-owned. And across all three of them, he had shot and killed eight people. Of the eight people, seven were women, one was a man. And of the seven women, six were of Asian descent. And the news that came out afterwards in all the briefings was that authorities hadn't declared it a hate crime yet. And I know that many people were disappointed and even angry that for a long time, all the major outlets had headlines that, you know, just said something like eight dead in shootings in Atlanta massage parlors. A lot of people think that, you know, just because law enforcement hadn't declared a hate crime, news outlets should have still pointed to the very glaring pattern that six of the eight victims were Asian women. And not just in headlines, but even tweets and the leads of stories. And by not doing it, it felt like for a lot of people that the media was dismissing the racial aspect at a time when we're going into a year of racist attacks, verbal and physical, on Asian Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like I know the Asian American Journalists Association has sent out several alerts, you know, asking the media to be responsible and to report on these hate crimes that have been happening, this surge in hate crimes, because it has been underreported. It was reported early on that the motivation for the crime was not racially biased, but had to do with the alleged shooter's sex addiction. And I'm just wondering if you can help us unpack this and why there's more to just saying something like that on its face.
Sure. So the way that Cherokee County Sheriff's Captain has framed it, who, by the way, is no longer the face of the investigation, the way he framed it, it sounded almost like the police were being very dismissive of the possibility of race being a factor. And it even sounded at times, you know, like they were even taking the gunman's words at face value, because they said, well, we don't know if it's racially motivated yet. And also because the suspect said it wasn't, and, you know, he was battling a sex addiction. And that very much angered the Asian American community out there in Atlanta, because you have to acknowledge that, look at how many of the victims were Asian, and the three crime scenes are all Asian-owned businesses. So there's no surprise that there was plenty of strong backlash, because it made it sound like you can't have sexual and racial motivations at the same time.
Or that,
and then also saying, oh, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, or that sexual motivations aren't within the classification of a hate crime.
Right. There's such a long history of Asian women, Asian American women, having to deal with sexism and racism, you know, intertwined, and Asian women just always being seen as promiscuous or sexually available or submissive. And with law enforcement saying that the gunman was struggling with a sex addiction and that the shooting was a way to eliminate his temptations, it could be seen by some people as trying to make the shooting victims, like, you know, a complicit in their own death, like they might have done something to contribute to this. And, you know, because that the gunman was dealing with this plight, but, you know, and but it's the victims who were having a bad day. Mm. And
right. And I mean, we should mention that the sheriff is initial, you know, he just sort of responded with, he finished off talking about this, you know, it's from a sex addiction and things like that. And he said he just culminated in a bad day. And that's something that is like, I think a lot of folks really considered in really poor taste to present it in that way. But it's, you know, it's the media's responsibility to sort of synthesize these things that are being shared and to present them in the most responsible way. And so I wonder if you might also share, like, some of the headlines that you saw. I know Reuters had to retract a headline something about, again, focusing on the shooter instead of the victims, and saying something about him, that he was a churchgoer or something like that. What did you think of that when you saw that, Terry?
Yeah, I did see that. I think, yeah, it was a headline and a tweet just saying, well, you know, a random gunman had gone to church. And, I mean, it was very unfortunate because it just sounded like if they were humanizing him and there had still not yet been much about the victims. And I know there's always a strong debate about, you know, how much do you talk about the gunman, especially if you're not talking about the victims. And again, it's almost like humanizing him when... And not focusing on, you know, the possible pattern here of racial motivation in the shooting.
How do you feel like the media can do better to cover Asian American and the Pacific Islander communities?
Well, I'm really hoping that newsrooms around the country right now are reassessing their staffing and, you know, looking to see if maybe we need to hire more AAPI, Asian American Pacific Islander reporters, photographers, and editors. Because, you know, sometimes if there's only one Asian American on staff, and that it falls on that person to carry the burden of being the one to make sure that something isn't culturally tone deaf or insensitive. And there needs to be more people to help with that. And also something else that AAJA noticed within like a couple days after the shooting was that they were getting reports from several of their own members in broadcast and even print that they were being turned down by their managers when they offered to help cover the shootings because, you know, they had offered because they have language fluency in Chinese or Korean, or they understand like the cultural sensitivities needed to approach these communities. But some of them heard from supervisors that said things like, maybe you're too emotionally invested, or you might be too biased, which, you know, to me, that doesn't make sense. You wouldn't tell, like, a Jewish reporter, well, the suspect was Jewish, so you shouldn't cover it.
Or all of the white reporters that they can only cover people of color.
Exactly. And, you know, in fact, newsrooms should be capitalizing on those kinds of staffers. You want people who can deftly go into, you know, whatever community, Asian American or otherwise, and who maybe have already forged relationships in those communities.
Mm. Lindsay, is this sound familiar to you?
Oh, yes. I was going to say, Terry, say it again louder for the folks in the back. That sounds, a lot of those comments you just tapped on sounds very familiar, particularly hiring, bringing in, further diversifying newsrooms to bring in more voices so that you don't put an employee, in a reporter or a copy editor or a photographer, in the position of having to be the token, of having to speak for the entire community, whether it's an Indigenous community, AAPI. Yeah.
And
preach, Terry, preach.
Terry, anything else you want to share about, you know, how we as news consumers can also be more responsible and more educated about, you know, when we're reading these types of stories?
Just, you know, read more than one outlet if you can, and also notice like who they're interviewing, because one thing that AAJ wants to encourage and remind news outlets is that, you know, when you're doing reaction stories and you're looking for experts or academics, reporters should try to find people who reflect that community or the diversity within that community. For example, I recently helped write a story on the history of stereotypes involving Asian women, you know, that were evoked by the shooting. And we found multiple scholars who were all Asian American women. And I think that lent a lot more credence and depth because, you know, they all not only shared their expertise on the subject, but they shared their own personal stories. Mm. So I think, you know, if readers look for that, you know, then they'll know that they're getting something stronger and just rooted in authenticity.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. Terry Tang is a reporter for Race and Ethnicity, the Race and Ethnicity team for the Associated Press, and president of the Asian American Journalists Association. And Lindsay Krebel Burton is with the Tulsa World. We really appreciate both of you being on the show today. Thanks so much. And we're going to switch gears now and talk about the Violence Against Women Act. If you want to get in on our conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. On the phone, we have Juana Maho-Dixon. She is the Secretary of the National Congress of American Indians Executive Board, and she is from the Palma Band of Luceño Mission Indians. Welcome to Native America Calling, Juana.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you pretty good. Thanks so much.
Everybody says that. It's almost like my name's Juana. Can you hear me okay?
Also, we've got Mary Catherine Nagel. She's the partner at Pipestem and Nagel PC, and she's a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Welcome back, Mary Catherine.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me. Hi, Juana.
Hey.
Thanks so much to both of you. I just, you know, we've talked a lot about the Violence Against Women Act through the years, but it still hasn't been completely reauthorized yet. And I'm just wondering if maybe you can, Mary Catherine, maybe you can talk to us about, first, maybe give like a quick overview of what the VAWA is.
Sure. So the Violence Against Women Act is a law that was first passed in 1994, and it is designed to address violence against women in the United States. And unfortunately, it wasn't until 2005 that the tribal title was added, but because of the hard work of our Native women advocates and tribal leaders, in 2005, they did add the tribal title. And in 2013, in that reauthorization of VAWA, we were able to secure a partial restoration of tribal criminal jurisdiction to address the United States Supreme Court's decision in Oliphant from 1978, when the Supreme Court said tribes cannot exercise criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians. And so that was VAWA 2013. It does require a reauthorization from Congress every 5 years. And we tried to get it reauthorized in 2019, but it stalled out in the Senate due to some partisan politics. And we're hoping to get it done this year.
And what exactly needs to be reauthorized? Can you unpack that a little bit more?
Well, VAWA does contain a lot of funding mechanisms, although technically, the funding can continue so long as Congress appropriates it. So it's not actually, some people will say, oh, VAWA expired, you must have lost all the funding for DV programs. And that's not quite true, mm-hmm. so long as Congress continues to appropriate it. But we don't want to sort of lessen the importance of reauthorizing VAWA, because it's a really important opportunity for advocates to really assess, is the law actually protecting all of our vulnerable relatives, including our Native women, immigrant women, you know, Black women, other women of color, our Two-Spirit relatives, LGBTQ. You know, there's a lot of populations that suffer disproportionate rates of domestic violence and sexual assault, and we just really need to constantly look at the law and make sure that, you know, we're protecting everyone.
Juana, how significant is it that the House passed this recently?
Any forward movement in this time regarding these tumultuous crimes and horrific statistics is a step forward. But the continuing process and the reeducation of Congress often can delay this, and or the ownership that the country feels they have, country being the U.S., to can also then take time to reinterpret, understand that trust, responsibility, and obligation to protect and provide protections in the manner that the tribes and tribal leadership bring forward. And when that isn't understood, it, as you know, the if it's not taught to them and they don't know, they're not going to have an immediate, if not at least a conciliatory response. But I think, in truth, it's a daily walk for us every single day, every single year, so that when we get to this moment in time to have it reauthorized, it's essential.
Hmm. And Mary Catherine, let's talk about the special domestic violence criminal jurisdiction section of this law. I know that you were mentioning in 2013, this is really significant because some tribes can prosecute non-natives for specific crimes committed on the on tribal land. Is there? But I do also know that there's. We've had folks on the show who have said it's not perfect or it needs some updating, things like that. So in this most recent reauthorization that passed the House, is there anything updated in that special domestic violence criminal jurisdiction section?
Yes. So, you know, it's important to note that Oliphant wiped out all of our tribal criminal jurisdiction. Basically, every single category of any crime that a non-Indian commits on tribal lands was gone after Oliphant. 2013 VAWA only restored three categories of non-Indian criminal jurisdiction, and that is specifically dating violence, domestic violence, and violation of protection orders. That leaves out every other crime that a non-Indian could commit. And so what a lot of our tribal advocates realized after VAWA 2013 that, you know, tribal law enforcement and tribal prosecutors, tribal courts, tribal nations still cannot prosecute child abuse, elder abuse, stranger sexual assault, trafficking, assault on our law enforcement, obstruction of justice. These are all serious crimes that plague our tribal communities. And those are actually all categories of restored tribal criminal jurisdiction that are included in H.R. 1620, the bill that just passed the House.
Oh, interesting. Let's talk more about that, but we've got to go to a short break. If you want to get in on this conversation, give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're talking with Mary Catherine Nagel from Pipestem and Nagel PC about reauthorization of VAWA. Also, Juana Maho Dixon. She's from NCAI. And if you want to get in, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. You can tweet us at 1-800-99-NATIVE as well. We're going to go to a short break. After the break, we'll talk more about VAWA. And then I have an interview with Secretary Holland.
Did you know COVID financial relief in the form of forgivable PPP loans is available to small business owners and independent contractors, including artists? DreamSpring has worked with New Mexicans looking to open or expand their business for over 25 years, and now they're helping provide PPP loans. Information, including how to qualify, at dreamspring.org. That's dreamspring.org. DreamSpring supports this program.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. I'm Monica Brain, and it's our monthly news roundup. We're talking about the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA. Mary Catherine, before the break, you were mentioning that child abuse, elder abuse, trafficking will all be included in this latest reauthorization that just passed the House. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. So these are just additional categories of tribal criminal jurisdiction that were taken away in 1978 by the Supreme Court's decision in Oliphant that we're hoping Congress and President Biden will restore. And so now that those have been included in H.R. 1620, all eyes are on the Senate to see what they will do next. And we're hoping that they will also, in a bipartisan fashion, I should mention that the House bill, there were numerous Republicans who signed on to it, so it was not simply a Democratic bill. It was very much a bipartisan bill, and we're hoping to also see a bipartisan bill in the Senate that also includes the same language and the same tribal provisions.
Yeah, I think I read it was like 56 Republicans in the House voted for it, which is pretty significant considering, you know, this is a largely Democrat-led bill. Juana, anything else? What do you think the chances are of it passing in the Senate?
I think there's a robust chance. When you consider the fact that we have managed to move forward on the NIATOPA, which is the Native Youth and Tribal Officer Protection Act, and our Justice for Native Survivors and Sexual Assault, when we realize that often the catch of putting everything in one basket can be more disjointed as opposed to working out the sections to be precise in terms of addressing the jurisdictional fixes that need to occur, as well as Mary Kay had indicated, the money involved. And it's a climate in which I know that it's better for everyone to move forward, and it doesn't change much from what was the original provisions, other than looking at what needs to be achieved in understanding the jurisdiction. When you consider also the fact that our police officers are counterparts in this, and our responding boots on the ground tribal advocates in the jurisdictional piece, you have to understand with Tuloa, we have a relationship with the Department of Interior, Department of Justice, and Department of Human Health and Services that was required to do in order to carry out that provision set of Tuloa, the Tribal Law and Order Act. And when you have partnerships like that, the same thing needs to happen as we do this work, but from the tribal leadership perspective, as well as our attorneys, our subject matter expertise. And that's an important part, understanding federal relationships. And that's one of the things we need to anchor down to get those counterparts, as you configure just with Department of Justice, what they do, what Department of Interior and what they do, and what Department of Human Health and Services does.
Mm-hmm. Mary Catherine, I don't know if you heard the conversation we were having earlier with the journalists about we had somebody from the Asian American Journalists Association mentioning that her colleagues were, you know, being told by editors that they could not cover the Atlanta shooting and things like that because they might be biased. And this is something that we hear a lot with Native journalists as well. And I just can't help but, you know, bring a parallel to this conversation about tribal courts and the opposition to, you know, this special domestic violence criminal jurisdiction section, that these courts are biased and that there's no way we could possibly, you know, they could get a fair trial. And I wonder if you might speak to that and whether or not you're hearing some of that opposition from folks in the Senate.
Yeah, you know, it's a real concern that we have because it certainly was an argument in 2013 that, you know, Congress could not restore tribal criminal jurisdiction because tribal courts are just bad courts. They're, you know, not legitimate. They're not staffed with human beings that are capable of fairly administering the law. It will, you know, inevitably result in due process rights violations for American citizens and all kinds of fantastical statements that simply have proven to be false in the last 8 years since VAWA was reauthorized in 2013. And instead, what we've seen is clear documented evidence that tribal courts are just as legitimate and just as capable of administering justice than state and federal courts. And, you know, the boogeyman argument that, you know, tribal court judges are somehow going to use this opportunity of restore tribal criminal jurisdiction to get back at some white guy defendant for the last 500 years of history is ridiculous and prejudiced and undermines the sovereignty of our nations. And, it, you know, at the end of the day, I can tell you as an attorney that advocates on behalf of Native people, I've represented many Native clients in federal and state court who have been discriminated against because of the color of their skin or the political nature of their identity as a citizen of a tribal nation. And the Supreme Court and Congress have never considered taking away the jurisdiction of state or federal courts, even when we have documented evidence that those courts have been unfair and violated due process rights. And this idea that tribal courts should lose jurisdiction because we're going to assume that they're incapable of fairly administering justice, not because we have proof that they are, but we're going to assume that, is really problematic. And yet, even though the last 8 years have been a huge success, there are still members of the Senate who perpetuate those prejudiced beliefs. And so we are up against false narratives and we have to discount them. And it's frustrating and unfortunate, but yes, those are some of the battles that we continue to fight.
Well, I thank you both so much for being with us today. And we are going to definitely keep an eye on this for sure as it progresses through the Senate. Mary Catherine Nagel is a partner at Pipestem and Nagel PC. And Juana Maho Dixon. She's the Secretary of the National Congress of American Indians Executive Board. And before we switch gears, let's take a call. We've got Caroline in Las Vegas, New Mexico, tuned in on KUNM. Hey there, Caroline. What did you want to share?
Oh, I wanted to share a family story because I moved to New Mexico in 1953. And things were a lot different then.
Okay.
My father used to supply items to the reservation, and he was the only white man who did business with many Native people. He came home one day and said, "We have to stop selling a particular item because it was proving dangerous to Native people who didn't understand." And he called headquarters in Chicago and said, "I won't sell it anymore because it's not clear about how they should use it." And I'll never forget that. We stood up even in those early years. And I'm so happy to see Deb Holland actually, you know, I'm giving her a shout out from a white person.
That's great. Thank you, Carolyn, for giving us a call. We appreciate it. Also, if you are just stumbling upon this in a podcast, you can go to our website and post your thoughts directly on our website as well. There's a few other ways you can contact us. You can send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. And we do check that email. Or if you want to send the email directly to me, my email is mbraine, B-R-A-I-N-E, at nativeamericacalling.com. It's been a pretty amazing week to see the first Native American as a cabinet member in the presidential cabinet, to watch her get sworn in. So I had an opportunity yesterday to talk with Interior Secretary Deb Holland about her priorities for her time as the first Native American cabinet member in Congress, in the cabinet.
Well, I'll tell you, my number one priority is ensuring that it's the same priority as President Biden, and that is us getting past this terrible pandemic. I was very proud to be able to vote for the American Rescue Plan when I was in Congress, and that, I think, is monumental. It's historic, the package that will provide much-needed relief for families across the country, of course, but also for tribal governments. And as the Secretary of the Interior, the wildlife-related pandemic initiatives are absolutely important. So, you know, we've been dealing with this pandemic for a year, and the challenges that all of us face are significant. And so we've also seen that the pandemic has disproportionately impacted American Indians, Alaska Natives, communities of color, rural communities. And so what the American Rescue Plan will do is to make sure that those communities have the resources they need to get past this terrible pandemic.
Can you share a little bit more about specifically the resources that are went through the American Rescue Plan to the Interior?
You know, what we've tried to do is make sure that we have an all-of-government approach, that not just the Interior is ensuring that tribal communities can get past this, but all agencies, all departments have a say in this. And I just found out that there's going to be $450 million for Indian housing block grants. That was announced today. Our principal deputy assistant secretary, Brian Newland, had a tremendous tribal consultation with tribes across the country. So we're working to make sure that tribes get what they need. But look, $900 million for the Bureau of Indian Affairs, that will include direct aid payments to tribal governments and funding to address concerns related to housing, as I mentioned, and potable water. We've seen that that's been an issue. $850 million for BIE, the Bureau of Indian Education, which will benefit BIE-funded schools and tribal colleges and universities. And, of course, you know, the tribal consultations will be important so that we know how we can best help tribes.
You know, thinking about the previous administration, how will consultations be different with this administration?
Well, certainly we want to make sure that we're meeting tribal leaders in the ways that benefits them the most. You know, today I was able to participate in the tribal consultation on the telephone. Some tribes, as we know, don't have broadband internet service, and so it makes sense that we can all use a medium where tribes have the opportunities to participate. So you can bet that with respect to tribal consultation, we'll actually consult with tribes on the best way to accomplish that. And I just want to make sure that the voices of folks who haven't been heard are heard. I'm confident that also under Brian Newland's leadership, we'll get there.
And I know you got to get going, but what are some of your other priorities that you're really anxious to get working on when it comes to the interior?
Well, of course, yesterday we were able to announce the bald eagles here in this country. They're in a great place. The numbers are growing. They're robust across the country. That is a success story that I hope we can replicate. You know, as time goes on, we want to make sure that endangered species are doing well. We know that wildland fires are an issue. During my time in Congress, of course, working on the missing and murdered Indigenous women crisis, that it will still remain one of my priorities while I'm here at the Department of the Interior. And so this is my fifth day on the job. So I'm going to absolutely buckle down and you know, I've been getting a lot of briefings, but I just, you know, I want to say that my priorities are the president's priorities, and getting past this pandemic is really job number one. We're going to work hard on that.
And that was Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, member of Laguna Pueblo, sharing with us her priorities for the, you know, for her time in office. And that's going to wrap it up for our conversation today. If you have anything that you'd like to share with us, you can send us an email to comments@nativeamericacalling.com. Next week, we've got a lineup of five great shows for you. On Monday, we're going to talk, we're going to continue our series on Native women in history, and we're focusing on artists this time. We're going to talk a little bit about Teyata, the Chickasaw actor and storyteller. On Tuesday, we have a Book of the Month show. That's the monthly show that we do where we talk with a Native author and we give away 10 books. Wednesday, we're going to talk about traditional views of bears, bears across the country. And Thursday, we're going to talk about repairing or reaffirming Trump's legacy with tribes, whether or not the Department of Interior is reversing something the Trump administration did. In particular, we'll look at the Mandan, Hidatsa, Arikara tribes' control over the Missouri River's mineral rights. And Friday, we're going to talk about TikTok and all the natives on TikTok. If you don't know what it is, it's a app where you can share a short video, fun dance videos, things like that. But there's a lot of native people out there sharing some pretty serious and important native knowledge through this fun app. So it should be a good conversation to have. And if you've got a suggestion for a show idea, again, you can email us at comments@nativeamericacalling.com. Thanks so much to our guests, Lindsay Crable Burton, Terry Tang, Mary Catherine Nagel, Juana Maho Dixon, and also thank you to Interior Secretary Deb Haaland. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our host is Tara Gatewood. Our associate producer is Andy Murphy. Marino Spencer is our engineer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director, and Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our resource development specialist. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor and producer for National Native News. Charles Sather is our Chief of Operations. The President and CEO of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm Senior Producer Monica Brain. Have a good weekend.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Og siger og jælle nu denne dækker, gudla ulskædde, nogu sinne til gæsse i. Udlænne da nåtik, gåhvælo de dårdåre, marketplace gudla, anskædde, hiskædde i jikkohida. Tætla nåhætan i jævja, og jælle nu denne dækker, en accessdiske. Naske i gæd stæla, at healthcare.gov, alle 1-800-318-2596. I a gæd til nåse Medicare, alle Medicaid unna dalga i.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.